At this time, it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Eli Shapiro. Dr. Shapiro has spent the last many years, he's founded and he directs the Digital Citizenship Project. He has presented to audiences around the country, perhaps around the globe, to enable schools, yeshivas, and families to deal with the digital age in a meaningful, productive, safe way. And it's now a pleasure to call upon Dr. Shapiro.
Good evening. Good microphone. You lost it? All right. Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. First of all, I just want to say the statistics piece, they asked the question in recovery, in addiction recovery, what percentage of people actually recover? And the answer is 100% of the people that are committed to recovery recover. So I think it's important to keep that in mind when we talk about statistics, that is an important piece of it. So a lot of you may have heard about me or looked into my website and some of the work that I've done in the past. Can everybody hear me? Hear me in the back? Yeah, good. What you probably don't know about me is that I am an alum of Torus Emes, and I'd like to share that. That's me up there. I was told that my fabulous pants don't meet the dress code anymore. I was going to wear them tonight, but anyway, so it's a privilege to be here, so much so, if it's okay, just give me 1 second, sorry. Can everybody squeeze in a little bit? Yeah. Okay. So just by a raise of hands, how many of you think you're here for an internet safety speech? Internet safety? A few of you? Okay, what I want you to do is I want you to shift the paradigm a little bit. And we're not just talking about internet safety, but we are talking about technology as a whole. Technology as a whole, our relationship with technology. What does it mean? It is a relationship. We need to think about it in those terms. Just by a raise of hands, how many of you experience what we call phantom vibrations? That's when your body vibrates, but your phone's not around, right? You know what I'm talking about? Twice? Two hands up. Okay. He really experiences it. That really underscores the relationship that we have with technology. We literally do not know where our bodies end and the technology begins. That's how much it has taken as part of our lives. And technology is moving at such a fast pace, we can't necessarily absorb it in a healthy and responsible way. And those phantom vibrations is our body telling us that we are so dependent and enmeshed with our technology, and it's something that we really need to pause and think about. Purdue University did a study, and they found that 89% of people experience these phantom vibrations. So really, when we think about society, where we are with technology, we are so enmeshed that we are experiencing these phantom vibrations, and that's really just indicative of the relationship. So I have the Digital Citizenship Project, and it started when Obama was president. So people would ask me, is this some pathway to citizenship through the digital, the internet? But the truth is, the Digital Citizenship Project are the norms of appropriate and responsible behavior when it comes to technology. The norms of appropriate and responsible behavior. So if I were to ask you that, Rabbi Bauman, thank you so much for bringing me down, but you brought me down and I stop and I take a selfie at the beginning of my speech. Is that normal? Oh, you don't have to say no right away. You can think about it. Take a minute, process, say no. Is that appropriate? Is that responsible? The challenges that we have today is that because technology is moving so quickly, we don't necessarily have time to process. Is that better? We don't necessarily have time to process what is normal, what is appropriate. If I were to tell you that typing in all caps, what does that mean? I can't hear you. You're shouting, right. So if you're typing in all caps, it means that you're shouting. So we agree on that. But other behaviors we don't necessarily agree on. I was at a wedding not too long ago where the brother of the bride was walking down the chuppah.
We did.
The brother of the bride is walking down the chuppah. He stops as he's walking down. He pulls out a selfie stick, and he takes a picture. So I'm looking, some of you look horrified. Other of you look like that's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Maybe I don't have to hire a photographer on my next Simcha. A friend of mine did this at a wedding. You know, just so you don't think I'm cyberbullying anybody, everyone in the picture gave me permission to use it. And the individual in question is proud to be known as the questionable selfie guy. He likes the role so much, so he recently got remarried and under his own chuppah took a selfie. So again, I'm not here to say whether it's normal, appropriate, responsible, or any of those things, but clearly we have different values, different expectations, and that makes it very hard. One of the challenges that we have, our children are the first generation growing up in this technology-drenched society, but we're the first generation of parents raising them, and we're the first generation of mechanfim teaching them. And so we don't necessarily know how to approach it. And it's a real challenge for us. And one of the things that a lot of parents are looking for is what we call the magic pill. The magic pill. What age should I get my child a device? What's the exact amount of screen time? Which filter should I get to solve all my problems? That's a magic pill. And unfortunately, it doesn't exist. It would be nice if it did. But technology is a really complex issue. It's part of our lives, and it requires complex answers. We live, and I like to say, in the best of times and the worst of times. Anybody hear that before? Yeah? Charles Dickens wrote that. He said it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. And I really think if we ever lived in a time that was the age of wisdom, the age of foolishness, this is it. Technology is amazing. It really gives us tremendous opportunity. It offers us accessibility, productivity, information, connectivity. There is so much wonderful opportunity that is presented as a result of technology. I think I appreciate it more than ever before. I have a daughter who's in Eretz Yisrael now, and I know what some of you are thinking is, how can a guy so young have a daughter in Eretz Yisrael? Moisturizer is what does it. But the idea of connectivity, that we can talk, that we can connect via FaceTime, is a wonderful opportunity, but it also presents challenges. The challenge is that the idea of going to Eretz Yisrael for years to separate from your family and to be immerse yourself in that experience and to be in a yeshiva or a seminary. And so being able to go back to your parents any moment presents its own challenges. There was actually a study that was done in the IDF where they had a vacuum of leadership. And what they found was that entry-level soldiers weren't making decisions on their own. Every time they had the most mundane question, they would text a superior officer. And so they were never going through a cognitive process. They were never weighing pros and cons. They were never challenging themselves cognitively. They were never making mistakes that they were learning from. And so without mistakes, there's no growth. And without that cognitive process, there's no growth. And so one of the things we're seeing in kids today is they're not developing effectively because of technology. But there are wonderful opportunities that present. So finding that balance, best of times, worst of times, age of wisdom, age of foolishness. And I see the four core areas that kids are being challenged in so many ways is their social functioning, their behavioral functioning, their psychological functioning, and their day-to-day functioning. These are the four areas that we're going to focus on tonight. Social, psychological, behavioral, and day-to-day. So I have to admit, I do love technology. Anyone else here join me in that? We like technology. It's not, you know. So much so, the UN did a study, if you believe studies from the United Nations, 6 billion out of the world's 7 billion people own a mobile phone, but only 4.5 billion have a toilet. When you think about that, that priority, where are the priorities? So clearly technology is important. We also have a generational disconnect. A lot of us feel that our kids know more about technology than we do. You ever get that feeling? It's hard to keep up with them. This is a conversation between a mother and child. Your great aunt just passed away, LOL. Why is that funny? It's not funny, David. What do you mean? Mom, LOL means laughing out loud. Oh my goodness, I sent that to everyone. I thought it meant lots of love. So we're laughing, but we've all been there where we didn't quite get the lingo that kids are using today. So we have a generational disconnect, not that dissimilar from the 1920s. You know, we're in the 1920s, the parents were speaking Yiddish, the kids were speaking English, and that created a challenge. Today, our kids are speaking digital, and we're still speaking the proverbial Yiddish. And so understanding the challenges that they are having, understanding how to communicate that, with them about that is really critical. I will say, though, we have a few things up on our kids. Our kids do not know what this is. They don't know what this is. In Chabad, they tell me it's a pushka. So. And they certainly don't know the relationship between these two items. I see some of the younger parents here don't know either, so if you could just turn to someone who looks a little older than you, they will explain. So first of all, I want to thank those of you that completed surveys. We had sent out surveys to the middle school, not to exclude anyone, but we find that the middle school is like a good barometer of, you know, you can just add some numbers to high school and reduce some numbers to lower than that. It's a good middle ground. I do speak a lot about statistics and data. Some people say I spend too much time on statistics and data. Actually, about 72% of people say I spend too much time on statistics. But I really feel that information data should inform what we do. It shouldn't define it, but it should inform what we do. My brother-in-law took it a step too far. When he was expecting his fifth child, he decorated the nursery in an Asian theme because he read a study that every fifth child born in America is Asian. So, you know, that's taking data too far. So I'm going to share some of the data that we collected. There's a logo for when it's local, and I will share with you when it's not. So 13% of kids in middle school own a smartphone. The national average, by the way, for a similar population is 16%. So nationally, overall, this is low, but even with a similar population, it's low. 58% of kids own an internet-capable device. So that would be an iPod or a Kindle or an old iPhone that's lying around the house. Social media is something that's very popular today amongst kids. You see Snapchat, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Qualitatively, they are very different, even though they're all social media. 14% of middle schoolers are active users of social media, and that's actually very low within the you know, the Orthodox yeshiva boys middle school population. The number's actually up towards 29% on a national level. So that was an interesting finding. Gaming, kids like video games, they play video games. 66% of you reported that your kids are active users of digital gaming. And it's actually also, it's below the national average, 73%. Fortnite, you heard of that? Everybody familiar? Your kids like Fortnite, they want Fortnite. 21% of the middle school reported that their kids play Fortnite. Those of you that don't know what Fortnite is, it's a game. I'm not going to go in depth to what it is. But it is a very addictive kind of game. It has certain qualities. I'm going to show this short video about this young man who was a tornado survivor, and in his own words.
I was sitting at home, and I was playing Fortnite, and all of a sudden I just hear a bunch of noise, and I look out the window, and I start seeing the roof come off the house in front of me. But then I sit back down because I only got like a couple people left in my gang. I'm gonna try to finish the game.
And what's going through your mind is you said you're in the bathroom with your sister and nephew.
I'm like, honestly, I was thinking about the game.
So when you think about these addictive tendencies, Fortnite's really, but Fortnite is just an example. You know, Fortnite, next year it'll be something else. Last year it was something else. So Fortnite videos, Netflix, YouTube, very popular amongst kids. 57% of kids here watch videos. In case you were wondering what the most popular were, 84% use YouTube, 47% Netflix, and 37% Amazon Prime. So these are some of the data and statistics, just so we understand. I will say that the technology ownership and engagement is lower, significantly lower than the national average, and in some areas even lower than similar populations. But it should inform what we do, not define it. So I'm going to begin the presentation. They told me that the Wi-Fi, I wasn't allowed to have access to it. So I'm going to log in the old-fashioned way. Always a fan favorite. So remember that, like 94, 95, where you know, we get those discs, 99 free hours, and we, you know, try to find a phone number that actually worked. None of them did. We go down the list, we finally find a number that worked. We wouldn't tell any of our friends and neighbors because we didn't want them on that number. And then you finally get on, someone in your house would pick up the phone, and then they get disconnected, and then you have to tell everyone, don't get on the phone, I'm going online. Like, this is a big deal in the house, we're going online. You finally go online, and there was absolutely nothing to do. You didn't have mail, no one cared. There was nothing to do. So that was, you know, but there was a certain menuchas hanefesh that we had back then, a calm, a peace that came over our home. This wasn't so long ago. This really, you know, really wasn't so long ago. And so the impact that technology is having, I think that we need to take, and you're going to hear me use these terms frequently, a thoughtful and deliberative approach when it comes to using technology. A thoughtful and deliberative approach. And in order to do that, we have to understand the impacted domains that we are experiencing. Behavioral, social, psychological, and day-to-day. So let's go into that. Behavioral. So we see in the behavioral realm dependence, distraction, impulsivity, disinhibition, and sleep. These are key areas that are being impacted. I think we can all relate to the experience of dependence and distraction when it comes to technology, but often overlooked are the areas of impulsivity and disinhibition. Impulsivity is when we do things without thinking about the potential consequences or the outcomes of our behaviors. So there's something about the digital realm that promotes impulsivity. 39% of students, again, this is Jewish day school and yeshiva students across the United States, admit to having texted or emailed something that they later regretted. So that's 39% of middle school kids admitting that. When I asked parents, only 4% of you said that your kids did something that they later regretted. So talking about that disconnect a little bit of what we think our kids might be up to and what they're actually up to, and I think that's something part of the paradigm shift that we have to have. When I was a kid, if I was angry at someone, I was told, you know, you write them a letter, you put it in an envelope, you wait a week, and by the time you're ready to send it, usually the issue has resolved itself. But today, when we're upset, we tweet, we blog, we post, we comment, we email, we text, we iMessage, whatever we can just to get it out there without thinking about the potential consequences. We just get it out there. And so there's something about technology that promotes this. Adults do this as well. It's not just kids. More than half of adults post messages that they later regret. 22% report doing so weekly. You might want to pull back a little bit on your technology use if you every week are doing something that you regret. So that is impulsivity. And impulsivity is a big part of how technology influences and impacts us. Online disinhibition. In 2006, psychologist John Suller identified the online disinhibition effect, and it's when online behavior and language is inconsistent with personal values and standards. In other words, the way we act, the way we speak in a face-to-face conversation, and the way we act and the way we speak online are different. Kids report that it's different. Adults report that it's different. We all know that we're more comfortable sometimes saying something that we wouldn't be comfortable saying in a face-to-face conversation through the digital realm. And so it's not just that if I am online with a fake screen name that I might misbehave. Even if I were to send you an email for my email address, ellie@elliechapiro.com, you know who it is. I know you know who it is. I'm still more likely to do or say something than I would in a face-to-face conversation. So that's a question we always have to ask ourselves anytime we engage in a behavior online, when I'm communicating with someone, when I'm sharing information, would I do this in a face-to-face conversation? Boys in the finest yeshivas, Erlich boys will say things that you can't believe when you read the text, when you read the communications, vulgar language. It's shocking, but there's something about the digital realm that promotes this behavior, and we need to understand it. This is not a new concept, by the way. Anyone who studied psychology, took Psych 101, you learned about Stanley Milgram or Philip Zimbardo. Stanley Milgram did the post-World War II electroshock studies. He was studying obedience, but what he also found was that when people were made to be anonymous, they would deliver longer, stronger, even fatal shocks. So there's a connection between anonymity and misbehaving. And the digital realm promotes anonymity. So when you have impulsivity and you have disinhibition, it creates a challenge for kids who, by their very nature, tend to be a little more impulsive and disinhibited as well. And so helping them to understand that behavior and modeling appropriate behavior becomes critical. 54% of kids sleep with their cell phones or devices within reach. Why is this an issue? They're online. They're either playing games, they're communicating with friends, they're not getting the sleep that they need. Why do they tell you they need their device within reach? Hey, you can answer it. An alarm clock. So they told you that down here too. It's like all over the country. The kids have convinced their parents. The alarm. Do you have amazing savings down here? Like a dollar store, Dollarama, something? Walmart? Okay, Walmart's good. So there's a section of Walmart. They sell these brown boxes with big red numbers, alarm clocks, and they're actually more effective than phones in getting kids up. So the challenge really is it does impact sleep. Artificial light from the phones makes it harder to fall asleep. Vibrating noises makes it more difficult to stay asleep. So we're clearly impacted by that. Harvard University did a study a few years ago where they compared reading a book at bedtime and reading an e-reader at bedtime. And you don't have to have gone to Harvard to figure this out, but if you read a book at bedtime, what happens? Yeah, Harvard spent money studying this. In fact, I have a book on my nightstand that I've been reading for the past 8 months. Right, and I'm still on page 2. And it's not because I learned on Kovetz Chaim. So what they found was that reading from a book puts you to sleep, but reading from an e-reader actually impacts sleep. And 53% of kids report staying up late as a result of technology. These are the kids reporting. The kids are saying, I stay up too late. Any teacher, any mechanech can tell you when a child comes in and didn't get a good night's sleep. You can see it on their face. They cannot tolerate anything. One of the biggest predictors of academic and social success in the school day for a child, for them to achieve their success, is a good night's sleep. So one of the biggest gifts we can give our children is making sure they get a good night's sleep. If they have an Alexa in their room, if they have any device, we have to make sure that it's out of their room and that they're getting a good night's sleep. That's the biggest gift we can give them to help them function during the day. So this is actually just a placeholder for me. This is a professional baseball player in a dugout with a cell phone in his hand. And it just reminds me to tell you the story of the time I had a meeting with the New York Mets. Any Mets fans here? There's always like two. Only two, always. I had a meeting. Anytime I have an audience, I like to start with a story that goes, I had a meeting with the New York Mets. And so I was meeting with them. They were actually concerned about players being distracted and how technology might be impacting them. What they told me was that one of their players was taking frequent bathroom breaks during the game. So initially they had a medical concern. As it turns out, he was updating his Instagram feed. So when you think about it, I mean, if you were at work and, you know, 45,000 people come, it's the Mets, so about 15,000 people come to watch you work, and you're so compelled to check your device, it sets a bad tone. You know, I was thinking about the parenting piece, the message that we sent. I was speaking in Cleveland a couple months ago, and the father said to me, you know, the question he always asks himself when it comes to his device, he says, what do I want my child to think that the apple of my eye is? Is it this apple or is it my child? And I think it's something to think about. What is the apple of your eye from a behavioral standpoint? I am guilty of it as well. I found myself a little while ago speaking with my daughter and reaching into my pocket and starting to pull my phone out. And then, like, what am I doing? I wasn't getting a notification or anything. It was just the compulsion to check our devices. And we have to be more aware and, again, thoughtful and deliberative in our own behaviors when it comes to our technology engagement. So those are some of the behavioral issues. Socially, digital distraction, social dependence, online aggression, cyberbullying, miscommunication, these are all areas that are impacted. We see scenes like this all the time. I call it a regression to parallel play. Little kids, they play next to each other, they don't play with each other. So we have sort of evolved into that as well. UCLA did an interesting study where they measured kids' ability to read facial expressions and social cues, because social connectivity is based on that. And so they measured their ability, and then they sent them to sleepaway camp without any technology. And what they found was that after only 5 days, the children's ability to read facial expressions, social cues, and form meaningful connections vastly improved, which is a fascinating study, because what it tells us is two very important things. One is digital technology is having a negative impact on our ability to connect with one another. That's one. Two, we can repair it. And we can repair it by separating from technology, by taking away less time, by not using technology. When do we connect best with our spouses, with our friends, with our family, with our children? When is that? I was going to say Thanksgiving, but Shabbos works as well. Shabbos is amazing. We have communication. We connect. We ask questions. We follow up. We make eye contact, right? What's the right amount of eye contact? You know, 100% is too much, right? That's like a little creepy. But ideally, you want to make eye contact about 60 to 70% of the time. And a recent study found that adults are only making eye contact 30 to 60% of the time. Only 30 to 60. Because a lot of that time is being taken up by checking our devices. We've also been conditioned to look for the next best thing. Everybody knows what FOMO is? Fear of missing out? That's the fear of missing out. So we look over people's shoulders, and you don't feel like you're making that connection, that meaningful connection. So I have a group of friends that we go out with fairly regularly, and we do this. We do what we call phone stacking. We go out to dinner, we pile up the phones. Whoever takes their phone first has to pay for dinner. right? So what we do is we actually have one friend who's completely addicted to his device. We invite him every time. I haven't paid for dinner in 3 years, and he hasn't figured it out, so it's working. It was interesting. I was reading the book, The Rebbe, by Talushkin, and something struck me. I'll read it to you. Some months later, Sharfstein was back in New York and returned to see the Rebbe. When she entered his office, he was carrying a tape recorder, the old-style tape recorder used in the 1950s, with spinning reels of tape, and she set it up, and the Rebbe asked her not to tape anything. He explained that when a person has a tape recorder, his or her attention becomes directed to the machine, and the person is constantly checking to see if the tape is moving, how far it's moved, whether it's coming to an end, and whether the tape needs to be changed. If you use the tape recorder, the Rebbe warned, you're not going to be listening to me intently, and I want you to listen to what I say and be involved in what I say, so don't use the tape recorder. This is in the 1950s. Just having the tape recorder on the table, the Rebbe felt, would serve as a distraction. And the research today indicates that as well. The mere presence of a cell phone on a desk reduces cognitive functioning. You don't have to touch it, the mere presence of it. They've done standardized testing with the phone, without the phone. Adults, if you want to focus, if you want to function, if you want to maximize your cognitive functioning, don't have the device there. We all know that we function better when the device is somewhere else. Even if we're not looking at it, the mere presence actually impacts. So that's something to keep in mind. Have you ever sent a text or any digital communication and the person completely misunderstood what you were trying to say? Or vice versa, you misread something? The issue is, in communication, 80% of it is paraverbal. Paraverbal meaning it's the tone, the volume, the intonation, the body language. It's not the words themselves. And so when you're communicating in the digital realm, you lack the paraverbal piece. I'll prove to you that it's not the words and that it's just it's everything else. Friday night, after we wash, before we make hamotzi, we have entire conversations without saying a single word. Uh-huh. New? Huh? Right? We're able to communicate because it's not the words, it's everything else. And so we miss that in the digital realm, how we communicate. Can we perspective take? How is someone else going to read what I'm sending? How am I communicating? And so the challenge that this creates for kids, middle schoolers into high school, that are starting to engage in technology communication, that miscommunication often evolves into cyberbullying, that aggressive behavior, the impulsivity, the disinhibition, the miscommunication. All of that contributes to negative behavior in the digital realm. My wife is the sisterhood president of our shul, the white shul. Actually, it reminds me, this morning at Shacharis, I knew that this was Hashgacha, I was coming here. I ran into Rabbi Zev Leff at Shacharis this morning. He said to send regards to everybody. So that was interesting. Anyway, so my wife is the sisterhood president of the white shul, and she organized a boutique. You know, a boutique, they have, men don't know what it is. It's vendors, and you can buy things. So she organized this, and she bought a hat for my daughter at the boutique. And the hat was too small. So she texted the person who she bought it from. Hi, it's Chai Shapiro from the White Shul. The hat I bought at the sale was too small for my daughter. I was wondering if I could exchange it possibly tonight. The response was, I'm so sorry your daughter has a big head. No returns accepted. Good luck. You know, my wife's like, oh, she's never coming back to the boutique. So that kind of communication, that behavior, that impulsivity, that disinhibition, it turns out it was the wrong person. So, but how does someone do that? What kind of communication are you thinking? Are you perspective taking? What is the impact of my words? And so that's something we need to think about and help our children understand when we communicate in the digital realm. 11% of kids have been the victim of mean or cruel behavior. This is in the Jewish day school and yeshiva population. So these are some of the social challenges that we see. Reduced engagement, reduced connectivity, and the miscommunication. All of these lead to diminished quality social interactions. All right, so that is behavioral and social. Probably my favorite area is the psychological realm. We see a relationship between anxiety, depression, isolation, addiction. All these areas are impacted by technology. When we think about anxiety, we've all been there where we forgot our cell phone at home, right? And then that panic, and we feel it right here. Like, oh my gosh, I forgot my cell phone at home. No one can get in touch with me. And like we panic, and the anxiety that creeps in. And those of us that are moderately well-adjusted, it goes from, oh my God, I forgot my cell phone at home, no one can get in touch with me, to, I forgot my cell phone at home. no one can get in touch with me. And like a peace and a calm comes over us. And you know, it's an amazing thing. By separating from our device, all of a sudden it's just wonderful. By the way, one of the things you can do, I do this in my house, to bring Shabbos in, or that menuchas and nefesh that we have when we're not on our devices, we go dark for dinner. We don't have any cell phones, any technology at dinner time. And it really makes a difference. You can speak to your children and find out what's happening for them. But back to the psychological piece, anxiety, depression. They surveyed thousands of kids, and they said, my cell phone is so important to me. It's the key to my social life. It's how I connect with other people. But what they actually found was the more importance kids placed on their devices, the higher their levels of anxiety, the lower their levels of subjective well-being, that overall happiness, and the lower academic performance as well, lower grades as well. And so understanding that relationship with technology, is it a healthy, functional relationship? And again, this all depends on the age that they are. Or is it an unhealthy relationship? Are they dependent on it? Are they addicted to it? And each one of our children are going to be different. So our children that have social anxiety or anxiety are more likely to develop unhealthy relationships with technology. And so it's important to keep that in mind as we approach. Each one of our children are going to need something different and something unique. I was raised as an only child, which was actually very frustrating for all my siblings, because you know, they all felt it was unfair. But the idea of approaching each one of your children as individuals and understanding their needs, their relationship with it, you're going to hear a lot of it's not fair. That's okay. It just means you're doing a good job. So... How'd that get there? If you forgot, just in case, I had a meeting with the Mets. So some people have favorite rabbis. Some people have favorite sports stars. I have favorite psychologists. This is how I roll, favorite psychologists. Not my own, per se. I don't like my psychologist. But my two favorite psychologists are Peterson and Seligman. They founded the positive psychology movement, and they did a fascinating study. Their study was called the Positive Journaling Study. And the Positive Journaling Study, they asked one group to write down five things at the end of the day that they were grateful for, and they asked one group to do nothing. And I know that it's you know, from people that daven three times a day, this isn't a far stretch, but the idea of expressing gratitude every day elevated subjective well-being. People were happier when they expressed positivity and gratitude. So when it comes to the digital realm, are you more likely to express gratitude and positivity, or more likely to express negativity? What do you think? Negative? I mean, Spirit Airline gets you to your destination on time with your luggage, which you paid a lot for. Versus, they get you there 6 hours late, and they lost your luggage. Which are you more likely to tweet or post about? The negative. And what that means is that we are literally partaking in creating a negative schema for ourselves, making a negative outlook on life. The more we write negative, the lower our levels of subjective well-being are going to be. And what one study found was that for every positive hashtag, a hashtag is just a fancy way of filing something online. So let's say you just had the most amazing salad ever, and you happen to have taken a picture of it beforehand. You might post it online and write hashtag best salad ever. And this way, anyone who's looking for the best salad ever, they would be able to find your salad, which is very important in today's day and age. I would actually say an appropriate way of using the hashtag would be hashtag best lecturer ever at Dr. Eli Shapiro. That's like an appropriate use of the hashtag. It's actually trending. If you want to jump on that bandwagon, it works. So that idea, are we using technology for positivity? Are we sharing a meaningful minute? Are we using it to promote positivity, or are we engaging in negativity? When we post negative, when we're upset, when we share something negative, our children see it. We're modeling negative behavior to them. So aside from the fact that we are making ourselves miserable, we're also modeling bad behavior for our kids. 70% of kids use technology longer than they intended. They can't regulate their own technology use. I think we've all been there as parents where our child comes home from school and they want to play some video games. And you're like, okay, you know, you can play for 20 minutes. You know, 3 hours go by, and then you remember, you know, you told your child they could play video games. So usually in most houses what happens is parents, we panic, and we go to our kids and we're like, go ahead, get off the, you know, computer, get off the video games. And almost never, I've never heard that they say, why, thank you so much. I hadn't realized my allotted time, I've extended it, and you brought it to my attention, and I really appreciate that. That really doesn't happen. So here's one parenting tip for the evening. When you realize your child has spent too much time on the computer in front of a screen, tell them 5 more minutes. 5 more minutes. You're going to give them a chance to transition. Imagine if we were doing something that we felt was important and someone said, you've got to stop right now. We wouldn't respond well. So you've got to give them 5 more minutes. In most cases, they'll tell you they're in the middle of a level. You know, I'm in the middle of a level. I can't. So then you can decide whether another 5 minutes. But that idea, if we want to be able to communicate and connect with our children, it has to be in a strategic and thoughtful way. Early exposure to inappropriate websites, graphic violence can result in emotional distress amongst kids. It's a lot more frequent than we would like to think. Recently, children may have been exposed to this. That is Momo, for those of you that don't know. One parent told me he was very thrilled that his child was exposed to Momo because now he doesn't want to go on the internet anymore. I'm just going to skip that. Most people are disturbed by that image. But 54% of kids, middle schoolers, yeshiva boys, have seen an image or video clip that disturbed them. 54%. When I ask parents here what percentage of your children have been exposed to an image or video clip that disturbed them, 12%. So again, that disconnect that Rabbi Luban was talking about earlier, that disconnect, what is going on in the lives of our children? Do we really know? 26% have looked up a website that their parents would disapprove of. 41% have accidentally ended up on a website that their parents would disapprove of. The average for a yeshiva family, the average, middle schoolers report only 35% of them report having all their devices that they have access to have parental controls or filters set on them. And so it's critical. It's of critical importance. It's not the only answer, but it's important because the filter is a physical manifestation of what our values are. We have to communicate those values, but we also have to, in action, show our children we mean business and that we are setting things up for them for success. So social, psychological, behavioral, day-to-day, some of the challenges we see, schoolwork, exposure, physical health, criminal charges, college, employment, dating, shidduchim. Our digital footprints, are what we have done online, what we say online, actually impact us. One of the opportunities that we don't have today that the Russian yeshiva that Rabbi Luban was talking about earlier that they had is that there was no digital footprint. There was nothing that, you know, 40 years ago, what they did as teenagers is all over and online. Today, our children don't have that luxury. Whatever they do now, whatever they post now is there, and we have to help them understand it's public and it's permanent, and it's there forever. Digital footprints, I've said this before, have a greater impact than your academic performance. We want our kids to do well academically, we want them to study, we want them to learn, but their digital footprint. Colleges today are asking for social media screenings. In Shidduchim, what do? Those of you in the parsha, if you want to find out about another family, you Google them, right? You go on Facebook. You see if they have a, do they have a Facebook profile? Do they not have a, oh, they do have a Facebook profile. I'm not a friend. Who do I know that knows them? Let me go see from there, right? We look into, but what is it that we're posting? What are we putting there? Kids need to understand everything is public and permanent. Every device has an IP address. Every network has an IP address. Every device has a Mac ID. I'm not going to go in depth to what those are. It's just basically it's a fingerprint for each device. You ever wonder why when you search for a pair of shoes online, all of a sudden your email, your social media, everything, those shoes are popping up everywhere? It's because your IP address is being tracked. It's being sold. Your IP address goes to an email address. The email address is connected to your real life, who you are. Amazon knows what your shopping tendencies are. You'll get. I was redoing my kitchen a few years ago, and I happened to have been looking for a wine fridge, an under-counter wine fridge. And Amex back then was doing like a weekly deal. And that week, they sent me a weekly deal for under-counter wine fridges. And I was like, oh my gosh, what hashgacha? It's like amazing. I'm looking for a wine fridge. Right. Well, I know now. I didn't know then. But what we do online, what we say online, how we act online, it's not just in the immediate that has an impact, but for a long time. Recently, 10 students that got into Harvard had their acceptances rescinded as a result of offensive comments they made in a private Facebook group. That wasn't like public, private Facebook group. And when you think of kids that get into Harvard, they tend to be more disciplined, more focused, than the average kid. But even they, on the in the digital realm, their behavior creates challenges. And so Harvard rescinded those letters. But these are issues that repeat themselves again and again and again, where opportunities are lost. And we may not know what those opportunities are. You know, even something, let's say you love President Trump, or let's say you hate President Trump. If you are vocal about it online, at some point, you're going to come across someone that doesn't share your views, and that may limit opportunities for you. And for our kids, they need to understand that the things they put out there, the things they say, can limit their opportunities. Sometimes you see things like this. You're not going to believe what happened when this girl drank a Coke. And click here. I can see some of you want me to click there. It's called clickbait. It like entices you. You get things like, you're not going to believe what your dentist isn't telling you. Any dentists here? I'm still trying to find that. Okay. So that idea, you know, a good example, kids being disturbed by imagery, even the quote-unquote kosher websites, you know, Vuss's Nias and Matzev and Yeshiva World News, they will show graphic violent videos. They'll just put a sash across and say, warning graphic violence. But now for most kids, that warning, it translates in kid language to click me. Or in some dialects, it's click me now. And that idea that kids will click through, and even that, a filter's not going to help you on quote-unquote kosher websites, but the content is disturbing. So when we look at technology by the numbers, and these are the numbers that you shared with me, 92% of you reported that you had set rules in your house regarding technology, 92% of you, which is a wonderful number. The only thing is that kids only report, 44% of kids report that there are set rules in their house. 85% of parents report having conversations about using the internet responsibly. It's also a very nice number. Thank you for doing a great job. The problem is only 33% of kids say their parents have these conversations. And 15% of parents report that their kids have been disturbed by online images. Video actually here was less. It was 4%, I think. Less. Maybe it was 15%. And 54%. So we see that there's a disconnect. There's a disconnect between what we think our kids are exposed to or what's happening in our own home around technology and what's actually happening for our kids around technology. And so but before I go on, whenever I have an audience, I like to try my mentalist skills. Everybody knows what a mentalist is? That's where I can look at you and think, know what you're thinking. So I'm looking at you. Look at me here, please. You're wondering why I'm picking on you. Is that accurate, sir? No. So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to do my magic mentalist move. Is it okay if we do this, by the way? Yeah. I'm going to do it anyway, because I'd like your support in this. All right. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to do my magic mentalist move, and then the answer will appear on the screen if I'm correct. Okay? What's 1 plus 1?
2.
Can I get a round of applause, please? You don't seem that impressed. Your child comes home from school. You say, how was your day?
Good.
Good, okay. Can I get a round of applause? The really good parents in the room don't let them get away with a good find. The really good parents follow up, what did you do today? Back. Well, that one deserves a round of applause. No, it's really remarkable. These are the communications we have with our kids. It's disingenuous because we know what they're going to say. They know what we're going to ask. How's your day? Fine. What did you do today? Nothing. Can I play, Xbox? You know, that's often how the conversation goes. I was speaking in Panama about a year ago, and they don't even speak English there, and the answer was nothing. So I don't know how that works. I was expecting like a nada. But that is, when we wonder why there's a disconnect between what we're saying, we have rules, we communicate about the internet, but our kids are saying we don't have rules and they don't talk to me about the internet, it's because we think we have conversations, but we don't actually, because the quality of the conversations needs to be focused and deliberate and clear and communicative, and that they understand that we've had these conversations. So the question becomes, we have social challenges, psychological, behavioral, day-to-day, what can we do? What can we do? Well, I'm out of time. Thank you very much. It's been great being here. The first thing we need to recognize is that there is no magic pill. These are complex times, and we need complex solutions for complex problems. And what we want to do is we want to find balance. We need to find balance. And the first way to find balance when it comes to technology, the first thing, the most important thing is, rule number one, we have to have rules. We must have rules. Those of you that don't have clear rules, then we're missing the boat. The kids need to know what our expectations are, what our values are. So the first thing is to have rules. Just because the rules are in our head that we don't want our children online past 10 o'clock, if we haven't communicated that, then there are no rules. And that's where that disconnects. So rule number one, we have to have rules. Only 44% of kids say there are rules in their house. Rule number two, discuss the rules. We actually have to communicate these rules to our children. So we have the rules, and then we discuss them. By the way, whatever the rules are, to me, and you should consult with your rabbi, but to me, they're secondary to having rules. It's more important that we communicate that there's a time for technology and there's a time not for technology. It's almost secondary what the rule is, whether it's we're going dark for dinner, or no technology, we heard the Harvard study, no technology an hour before bedtime, or if you're on a device, the door to your room has to be open, or no devices in your room, devices are only in a public place at a pre-approved time. Maybe that's the rule. Whatever the rules are that work for your home, they have to be there. Because if we don't have the rules, we don't discuss the rules, our children are not gonna know. And then rule number three is the hardest part, is actually keeping the rules. Keeping the rules. Have the rules, communicate the rules, and keeping the rules. And that is the start to managing and finding better balance in your home. One of the biggest challenges that I hear from parents is FOMO. Our kids have a fear of missing out. And then there's something called BED. Anybody know what BED is? I can tell this is a pious group. It's a BED Hashem group. It stands for But Everyone Has. And that's probably the biggest challenge that parents face today, because you don't want to get them the device, and you don't want to give them access to a different program, but everyone has, and it's a big challenge. I'm going to show a short video that really, I like to say that kids are like monkeys, not because I don't like kids, I really love monkeys. And so understanding the innate drive, I'll just show the video.
So final experiment that I want to mention to you is our fairness study. And so this gave a very famous study, and there's now many more, because after we did this about 10 years ago, it became very well known. And we did that originally with capuchin monkeys, and I'm going to show you the first experiment that we did. It has now been done with dogs, and with birds, and with chimpanzees. We started out with capuchin monkeys. And there's a very simple task that they need to do. And if you give both of them cucumber, for the task, the two monkeys side by side, they're perfectly willing to do this 25 times in a row. So cucumber, even though it's really only water in my opinion, but cucumber is perfectly fine for them. Now if you give the bark the grapes, the food preferences of my capuchin monkeys correspond exactly with the prices in the supermarket. And so if you give them grapes as a far better food, then you create inequity between them. So that's the experiment we did. Recently, we videotaped it with new monkeys who had never done the task, thinking that maybe they would have a stronger reaction, and that turned out to be right. The one on the left is the monkey who gets cucumber. The one on the right is the one who gets grapes. The one who gets cucumber, note that the first piece of cucumber is perfectly fine. The first piece she eats. Then she sees the other one getting grape, and you will see what happens. So she gives a rock to us, that's the task. And we give her a piece of cucumber, and she eats it. The other one needs to give a rock to us. And that's what she does. And she gets a grape. And she eats it. The other one sees that. She gives a rock to us now. Gets again cucumber.
Challenges that we have is when someone gets something, it becomes everyone needs to have it. And our kids will come home and say, everyone has this and everyone has that. And in truth, they probably don't. One of the great ways to finding out is actually calling other parents and finding out if they, but there's power in numbers. And technology is very much a socially driven norm. So that's why in different communities, we'll see in a middle school community, you have rates of as low as 13, 14% of smartphone ownership or 25% of device ownership. And then in other communities, it's 80% and 90%. It's socially driven. And so one of the things that I encourage communities to do, and school communities specifically, is influence the social norm. Influence it. Communicate with the yeshiva. Communicate with other parents in your class. Decide what it is that you want for your children. And postponing technology, engagement, ownership is a great opportunity. And if you can do that by influencing the social norm, it's a great thing to give to our kids. Let them wait a little longer to get their technology. So whether it's apps and social media, the maximum recreational screen time, ideal shut-off time, these are all things to communicate. One of the things that I do in communities is help classes, grades, identify the ideal shut-off time. So whether it's 7:30, no more screen time, 8:30, whatever it is, it's again secondary. The idea that no one else is on devices actually allows my child to not feel like they're missing out. And we can influence the social norms just by communicating with one another. There was a high school I spoke at. One of the high school, they give iPads out. Every girl in the high school had a smartphone except for two girls. And one of the parents of the girl came over to me and said, you know, I would think it would be a challenge for my daughter because everyone has smartphones, but just the fact that there's one other person that doesn't have a smartphone, that normalizes it for her, and she's okay with that. So you're never gonna get everybody on board. Well, you can try. But the idea of just getting traction, getting a cohesive group of parents to agree either no smartphones or no devices, or no social media, or no Fortnite, or I was speaking to someone earlier, I was saying the next thing is gonna be virtual reality gaming. You're gonna be like wishing for the time they actually had a screen but they could see outside the screen. You know, they're gonna put on these goggles and you're not gonna see them. So that idea of understanding what's coming at and setting the norms, influencing the social norms, is critical in helping our children succeed. Having a family plan. It's not just about our individual child, it's about us as parents, it's about our engagement with technology, it's what we communicate to our children. Of the students that we've surveyed across the United States, 51% of them say that their parents are the biggest influence on what they think is appropriate when it comes to technology. And by the way, we're talking about technology tonight, but this is really parenting in general. We as parents have a very large obligation and influence over our children. The next largest group, by the way, after 51%, it was about 23%, they said, no one influences me. Those are the really cool kids, you know, they play by their own rules. But the largest single group, that, by the way, as parents, we influence our children tremendously. But 51% of them actually admit and say, my parents are the biggest influence. So that's something to think, our role as parents is critical in approaching it. But only 33% of kids say that their parents have spoken with them about technology. And it's not just speaking with them about technology, it's modeling appropriate behavior with technology. Far too many studies find that kids say that my parents say one thing when it comes to screen time, but then they do something else. And so our own behaviors when it comes to technology has to be modeled appropriately. And by the way, as parents, we sometimes have obligations. We have employers, we have colleagues, we need to respond. It's okay to respond. Just be transparent. Tell your child, you know, I have this email I need to respond to, but then I'm all yours. Then put your phone away for 20 minutes and then connect. It's not even the quantity, it's the quality of the engagement. Just spending time letting your kid know that they're the apple of your eye and not your iPhone. When we look at the correlations, parents, the kids that say my parents influence me, those are the kids whose parents have talked with them about appropriate ways to engage in technology. They're the ones that report improved quality of homework, more time connecting with family and friends. The group that says no one influences me are more likely conceal their internet use, have online friends they've never met, not completed homework, not eat or skip meals, and receive images that their parents would disapprove of. We have to know the devices that we're giving them. We have to know the software that we're giving them access to, and we need to know their relationship with the technology. So we have to know when it is appropriate, and that's a conversation. It's understanding what the social norms are. We have to know what we're giving them. We can't just give them because Amazon has a sale that $35 you can get an Alexa or a Kindle doesn't mean that your child should have it, even if they say everyone else has it. We have to know what we're giving them access to the software. Fortnite, I think it was about 20% of the middle schoolers here played Fortnite. That reported, and it goes down young. Fortnite is rated age 12 plus. So if your child's under 12, even according to the standards of gaming, secular standards, it's not appropriate for children that age. So it's something to realize. Well, we have to know the devices, we have to know the software, and we have to know their relationship. Their individual relationship, might, even if they're 20, might not be healthy. And so we have to think about it in those terms. Only 35% of kids report that all the devices have parental controls on it. We have to raise that number. I know that Mokade was involved with this. I think they're involved with putting filters on devices, so it's important to recognize that as an opportunity. When we see things like this, Snapchat, Instagram, WhatsApp, qualitatively they are different. Snapchat is rated 12 plus, but you can't just go by what is rated 12 years old plus, because the reason it is rated 12 years old plus, I'm not going to go through all the nuances here, but it is something you should look up and understand that it's probably something you don't want your 12-year-old being associated with. So check every time you download software or game. There's a website called Common Sense Media that has very good descriptions of every app, every game, every video, and they will give you a much better understanding of if this is something that you want to expose your children to. I use a program called Hour Pact on my children's devices. These are two of my daughters over here. Bedtime, you'll notice, 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. is schedule in school, 8:30 to 4:15. Their smartphone, like Cinderella's pumpkin, it turns the character turns back into a pumpkin. Their smartphone turns into a dumb phone at the set time. So you can manage your children's devices. Hour Pact is one example of managing your children's devices. It happens to be what I use. But I recommend iOS, the operating system for Apple, not only because I'm a shareholder, but you should all buy Apple products, but it also is the most intuitive and native software to the devices. NetSpark is a good filter, HourPack, et cetera. When my daughter came to me and told me, but everyone has a smartphone, but everyone is out there, so at some point I recognized that basically her whole class at some point had one. And so what I did was I sat her down, I set up my projector and my computer, and you're getting the hour speech, she got the 4-hour speech. And it was amazing that she was able to see what I was presenting because her eyes were like so rolled so far back in her head. It was remarkable. But we went through a process and I explained to her all my concerns about technology, and I said, you come up with a contract that you think makes sense based on the concerns. What rules do you think make sense and what do you think will make me comfortable giving you a device? And so we went back and forth. She reviewed it with her people, I reviewed it with my people, back and forth. My people were me and my wife, and her people were her friends, who were really, I have to say, sympathetic to having me as a father. You know, because she would come to me and say, you know, all my friends have unrestricted internet access. And I'd say, oh, it's so sad that your friends' parents don't love them. Really sad. You know, things along those lines. And so, you know, people say to me, Dr. Shapiro, do you really think your daughter follows all these rules? Some of you are wondering that, right? So the answer is, of course she doesn't follow all the rules. She's a teenager. We've all been teenagers. We didn't follow the rules. But at least she knows what the rules are. If we never communicate what the rules are and what our expectations are, they don't know. I can't tell you how many times I speak to student groups, and they say, I wish my parents were more engaged with managing technology. I spoke in Boston a few weeks ago. The kid said, my parents are soft. They're soft. They understand the social, psychological, behavioral issues around technology. They want help with it, and we as parents need to be there for them. So it means spending time off of technology with kids. It also means sometimes spending time on technology with our kids. My son likes to play Madden, NFL, he's upset. He has 2018, all his friends have 2019. So he's upset. But I play with him, and he loves beating me because this is what I'm used to. And this is what he's used to. So it's really not fair. But that process we spend together, that time we spend together, and then we also do things outside of the computer. But it's important to meet them where they're at. If they're playing video games, and it's set, and it's limited, and you have rules, and you communicate the rules, it's okay to spend some time playing video games with them. But they can't. You have to demonstrate and model for them appropriately. You have to connect with them. It's okay for them to show you what they're doing online. My son likes to watch this thing called Dude Perfect. Any of you hear of that? Yeah, Dude Perfect? For those of you that don't know, Dude Perfect is a bunch of overgrown children running around doing trick shots. And I mean, from a content standpoint, it's kosher. But what ends up happening is kids spend a lot of time on it. So you have to balance that behavior. So 6 suggestions for family success. You have to understand your relationship with technology, your relationship, your children's relationship, the family dynamic around technology. Have tech-free time. Go dark for dinner. It's amazing what you'll gain out of just spending time without technology at the dinner table. Have personal rules and family rules. It can't just be about telling your child, you must do this. You have to have your own rules and family. I have a personal rule when I'm davening chakras with Talis and Tfilinon. I don't have my phone with me. I don't have my cell phone. No need to give me a round of applause, really. The women are wondering, why would you have a cell phone with you during davening? Like, not your husbands, other people in other communities. So, I don't have my cell phone with me during davening. The good news is my chakras is down to 6.5 minutes. But that idea of just being engaged, you know, there's a whole big mindfulness movement. This idea of just not being distracted, not being tethered, separate. We all know how good it feels. We put our phone in our room and then we engage with our family downstairs. I hear they're like old one-level houses. So you put your room in your, and just engage and forget about your phone for a little. The quality of those interactions are going to be so much better. So have personal family rules. Follow them. Communicate with your children about technology. Be transparent and model responsible technology use. We have to disconnect to connect. It's not just a catchphrase. The quality of the interactions, all the research is telling, the quality of the interactions without technology are so much more meaningful. We have to improve our dialogue with our children. It can't just be, how was your day, fine, what you do today, nothing, etc. It has to be a meaningful dialogue. And it has to be, all of this has to be in the context of a relationship. If we're just doing it to set rules, our children are going to see it as punitive and they're going to push back. But I'm always amazed at what I've been able to get away with my children just because it's in the context of a relationship. I care about you. I love you. I want to see you succeed. And my understanding of technology use is that it can interfere. I want it to enhance your life. I don't want it to be an intrusion. And we have to seek balance. We have to find that balance that makes sense for our community, for our school community, for our home, and manage the technology so our children can grow up at some point. They're going to have the challenges of technology, and it was pointed out earlier, we can't guarantee anything. We can't control everything. But I always talk about Yosef and Ignatius Potiphar. It doesn't say that he was restricted or blocked or filtered. Rashi brings down the most beautiful of it, that his father inculcated a value into him. He inculcated an idea that wherever he went, he carried that with him. And our goal as parents is to inculcate our values, whether it's about technology or anything else. We have to inculcate our values into our children so that wherever they go, they can make the right decisions. I just want to close with one two-minute video. I'd asked my daughter, who's an Eretz Yisrael, what was it like growing up with restrictive parents around technology? I asked her the question because she had a different experience than most of her friends. And she sent this back, and I didn't edit it. It's just, this is what she sent back at 2 in the morning in Eretz Yisrael. So.
So the annoying thing about having parents who are actually aware of the impact of technology and actually are doing something to protect their kids from it is that eventually you realize they were right and then you have to admit it, and that's not fun. But my parents were right, and I didn't get an iPhone until 10th grade when I had a smartphone. Which was definitely different than most of my friends. And when I finally got one, I had a lot of restrictions on it, and there was a lot of rules, and my father actually had me write up a contract of the rules that I thought were appropriate to have for an iPhone. And having all of that, like not getting it right away and helping make the rules, definitely gave me a greater appreciation for what a smartphone actually can do to you, and that it shouldn't be a given, and that it's not something I should be taking lightly. There are a host of psychological problems that come with it, and there's definitely an addictive quality, and an antisocial quality, and instant gratification, and all these things that you never want to agree with that are true when you're younger just are true. Not having your apps turn off at a certain time of the night definitely place more value on time. So if I actually needed started to use certain apps, I would schedule my time better, and just not being, having it, but not being so dependent on it and being conscious of it all the time definitely helped me in not being addicted to my phone. So having parents that did that, it, although it was annoying at times and frustrating, it's just another one of those parenting things that is just, you have to do it, you know, you have to do the right thing, even though it's hard to do.
So, she's not dating yet, so hang on to the resumes. But I think she said it best. It's just another one of those parenting things that you have to do. And we have to set limits. We have to give guidelines. We have to give our kids direction. And I'm optimistic. Rabbi Shapiro, you gave very inspiring words. And hopefully from tonight is just the first step. We spoke about technology's impact. We spoke about some of the strategies to move forward with. And hopefully we can do this as a community, as a school community. And this is the first step. And thank you very much for having me.